एक मिनट रुक जाओ, रेडी होने दो। चलो ये कर लेते हैं, दिस कुड बी अ ग्रेट इंट्रो।
हाय, आई एम अक्षय।
हाय, दिस इज सौरभ एंड यू आर लिसनिंग टू द फाउंडर थीसिस पॉडकास्ट। वी मीट सम ऑफ द मोस्ट सेलिब्रेटेड स्टार्टअप फाउंडर्स इन द कंट्री
एंड वी वांट टू लर्न हाउ टू बिल्ड अ यूनिकॉर्न।
Hi, I'm Shairi, founder of Shiros. If there's one thing I really care about, it's building women's internet, and I'm glad to be here.
I have been in a work-from-home job for quite some time now, and it has nothing to do with the coronavirus. I just happened to find an employer who was building a remote team, and working from home has actually boosted my career like never before. So, I am truly excited about this episode. Today, Akshadat is talking to the pioneer who introduced India to the power of women working in remote teams, Sairi Chahal, the founder of Shiros. Shiros is a platform for women who are heroes in their own right. Sairi built Shiros as a safe haven for women on the internet, a place where they can be themselves, where they can learn, build careers, build businesses, and make friends. Let us hear about the creation and journey of Shiros.
So, Sairi, I believe you grew up in Muzaffarpur. So, tell me about growing up in like a tier 2, tier 3 town in Hindi heartland. मतलब वो experience पूरा कैसा था?
बिल्कुल. So actually Muzaffarnagar, not Muzaffarpur. Although दोनों में ज़्यादा फर्क नहीं है. पहले हमें मालूम नहीं था कि tier 2 और tier 3 क्या होता है. अब थोड़ा बहुत blogs पढ़ के पता चल गया है. You know, life was very different back then. एक तो technology नहीं थी, internet नहीं था, दूरदर्शन हुआ करता था. Books were the only real means of information you had. So life was slow, I think, and life didn't have many options.
Tell me about your family. What were your parents doing?
My dad's a steel industry engineer. He basically expands and renovates steel plants. My mom is a homemaker now, but she's a revolutionary in herself. She was the first girl in an all-boys school. Then she went to do a lot of work with Family Planning Association of India. So more active and more liberal of the two parents. But my dad sort of gave me a lot of things that I still carry, you know, with me today. Reading as a habit, you know, finding time for walks and yourself, having a very large professional circle. So these are things I think I sort of got from my dad. And my dad's a quiet person. My mom is a very talkative person. So, and I'm a mix of both. So I think it's interesting how you pick up. I have a younger sister who's complete opposite of who I am. We used to fight a lot when we were kids. Just tease each other. But now we don't live together. She lives in Bangalore. I live in Delhi.
So what were like your childhood dreams while growing up? Like, what did you think you'd grow up to be?
Right. So I definitely knew what I didn't want to be, I think, first of all. So, you know, when we were in school, the competitive culture was at its peak. Everyone wanted to become a doctor or an engineer. And, you know, in small town schools, didn't even have like the liberal arts stream. Like, arts was for losers.
This was which decade?
This is 90s, 94. So, I was very clear that doctor nahi banna hai aur engineer nahi banna hai. Aur, कुछ करना है. लाइक आई थिंक दैट वाज द ग्रोइंग अप सेंटिमेंट. इनफैक्ट आई रिमेंबर आई हैड अ डायरी वेयर आई हैड रिटन बंच ऑफ थिंग्स व्हाट आई वांटेड टू बी. सो इट इंक्लूडेड एवरी रिसर्चर, सोशल साइंटिस्ट, राइटर, एंटरप्रेन्योर, बंच ऑफ थिंग्स दैट वर नॉट डॉक्टर्स एंड इंजीनियर्स. सो एंड आई थिंक गिवन हाउ मच आई हैव एक्सपेरिमेंटेड, बहुत पापड़ बेले हैं एंड बहुत सारी चीजें करी हैं लाइफ में. सो आई थिंक सम ऑफ देम हैव कम ट्रू नाउ. And when I was a kid, I remember setting up library for the children in the colony because I thought sab log bore ho rahe hain. So I collected books from all over, mostly mine and some from my friends. And we started renting books. It was called SNJC Library. Yeah, so okay. That's me and my sister's name basically. And I think one of those sentiments when I was growing up was that life needs to be more, you know, this ye canvas chota hai. And matlab wo ek feeling hai, the need to soar and the need to sort of like expand your horizons. Sentiment bahut clearly mujhe, you know, like I've carried it with me, I think, inside me for a long time. So mujhe wo feeling yaad. So, and then I finished school and I left Muzaffarnagar.
So by finished school, you mean like the 12th board you gave and then you left?
Yes. Yeah. I to pehle jana chahte thi. My dad was like, no, stay with us until you are in school. And so I left after 12th and moved to Delhi, went to JNU of all places. JNU us time pe itna popular nahi tha jitna aaj kal hai. So went to JNU, started working very early on. I think the big change in my life happened because I started working very, very early. And so by the time I had finished my master's, I had already worked for like 4 years.
So which course did you join in JNU?
I have a master's in Russian literature.
So how did you start working in JNU? You were staying on the campus only?
Yeah, I was in the campus and I stumbled upon what became my first assignment. And I think once you start working, then, you know, it's like taste of blood. You can't stop it, you know. And I think once your network gets, you know, word gets out. So my first assignment was actually giving tuitions to this couple in Ministry of External Affairs. They used to come every week to campus to take Russian lessons for me. You know, it was nice money for that time. It was nice, you know, nice to sort of, you know, spend your time doing something else. And because I did that one assignment, everybody in MEA knew that this is the person to go to for tuitions if you got posted to Moscow. So, you know, that happened. And because MEA knew me, then embassies got to know me. Once embassies knew me, then, you know, like, you know, this whole ecosystem is quite small again, you know, ministry and other people who work in close coordination with the ministry. So I did a bunch of odd jobs, translation, PR, writing, tuition, whatever, research, whatever came my way, whatever paid. But, you know, kind of set the tone for professional living. You're expected to show up, and you were, when you're working with, you know, the government and ambassadors, then you obviously sort of learn the business, you know, the decorum. You learn it much earlier, much faster. And by the time I got out of JNU, actually I didn't get out, I enrolled for my MPhil. But by the time I finished my my master's, I again stumbled upon what became my first startup. So built a company back in the day, 99. We set out to build what became world's first newspaper for mariners. We built a company called Link Services. Basically, kya hota hai ki merchant navy ships pay, you know, there are about 30,000-40,000 merchant navy ships that sail on any given day. And every ship has, you know, about 25-30 nationalities, right? So sailors come from, you know, developing world, India, Philippines, Spain, Poland. And sailor depression is a big industry problem because there's no news from home. You're away, cut out on the sea for many months on end. So we built a product where we would stream everyday news and sort of curate it a bit, put it in a country edition. So India would get an Indian edition and a Filipino would get a Filipino edition and so on. Once a day, we would get a satellite connection. Two sailing ships would download this on the deck, print it on, and then distribute it to sailors. So sailors started getting the news every day. And beginner's luck, hello. I have no idea about the shipping business. I had never been on a ship. This was somebody else's idea, somebody else's money, but really nice guy. I think he was kind enough to give me a chance. He took a, you know, shot.
What was the monetization strategy here? Like, were the sailors paying for it? Or, I mean, how did you make money in this?
So the shipping companies would pay. So, baad mein pata chala isko SaaS kehte hain. But basically, we would sell via shipping companies. We had a sales office in Cyprus and a production office in Delhi. So hum shipping companies would buy it for the number of ships and the number of sailors they have and enable it. So the company would buy the subscription. We would make the subscription live. And it was a prepaid product. So did well. We had about 2/3 of the market. Or koi nahi tha, matlab. But good going. Did that for 3-4 years. Very intense work. Learned how to build a company, startups, hiring, product. I didn't know any of this, but learned on the job, learned on the go. Worked really, really hard, I think. Harder than anybody else can. And yeah, and then left it after 4 years. After the company got acquired, it was up and running during 25, 26 editions. So, matlab jitna kaam tha kiya.
So, did you make money when it got acquired? Like, how significant was your stake in it?
So, look, I didn't invest a lot of money in it. I was the founding team. So, I didn't make a lot of money or, you know, any significant money. But I was better off than my peers. So, that was good enough.
So, around 2003 or 4, it must have got acquired.
Yes, yes. Then I moved out, got married, worked, started working with the CII a little bit. I still had my Russia roots, so started working on the Russia, set up the Russia office. This time pe Vajpayee government hua karti thi. Took the Vajpayee government delegation to Moscow. There was this big President Putin Vajpayee summit, which we set up. Bahut maze kiye, you know, Moscow mein kuch bataya.
And what was your husband doing at this time?
My husband's a journalist.
Okay. So, did you like meet on the job types, or it was just coincidence?
Not really. I was doing a small stint at a company called ANN before Newslink, and he used to work for the Bangalore office of the same company, but we never worked together. We used to always wonder who's this person. So that's how I met him, and then worked with CII. Fun assignment. Hung out with the Russians, had lots of vodka, lots of fun in Moscow. Life was good, I think. But CI was very slow. After Newslink, CI was like a, you know, nice little sabbatical, to be honest. From the pace and the freedom. I think startups, mein na, you get spoiled. Aapko, you don't ask anyone for anything anymore. Agar aap bas jo man mein aata kar lete, because startups mein kar sakte hain. But CI is a nahi tha, you know, world organization. Anyway, so did that, and then quit in about a year's time, year and a half, and then started working with this company called Heidrick and Struggles, which is a leadership consulting firm. Did again about a year and a half of that. Really good job, very well-paying job. But I still feel that was the least amount of work I did for the max amount of money I made. Very large organization, 64 offices worldwide kind of organization. Bilkul entrepreneurial nahi, you know, like leadership styles were very different. So didn't see myself sort of a lot of that. So moved on from that as well.
Okay. Then what next?
Yeah. And then I set up my first company called Saita Consulting to work with tech startups. You know, by this time, the first Series A and, you know, Naukri had happened, Make My Trip had happened, India Mart had happened, 197 was there. So, you know, I think the entrepreneurial scene was beginning to happen in India. And this is 2005. So I set up in 2006 and then worked with a bunch of tech startups to, you know, help them put things in place, systems, processes, SOPs, things that you need to do for scale as a founder, but bilkul incentive nahi isko karne ka. Except for, you know, you need these things for scale. They're not revenue generating, they're not IP generating, but they need to be done. So did that for 5 years and then set up Shiro's.
Okay. So what was the genesis behind Shiro's? Like, why did you decide to set it up? And so you shut down that consulting business, Saita Consulting?
No, I quit. I left it to my partner and moved out of it and then set up Shiro's. Look, the genesis of Shiro's was really, really simple. That, you know, I had practically seen internet grow in India, you know, from, let's say, 99 onwards to, let's say, 2010, 11, you know, the ecosystem came alive in, you know, in those 10 years, right? Like I grew up in small towns. I knew women never had a voice, but वहाँ पे ठीक था, right? मतलब यहाँ ऐसे ही होता है और मतलब ये tier 2 है, tier 3 है, but I always felt that women also are not represented adequately online, and हम लोग जितना internet से फायदा उठा सकते हैं उतना नहीं उठा पा रहे हैं. That was the fundamental thought. But And of course, you know, by this time I'd worked for a long time. I'd worked across organizations. I'd built my own experience. And I always felt that, you know, I mean, and of course, all our academic, if you look at it, you know, within academic lens, all our numbers don't add up either. Women in workforce numbers, women in leadership numbers, reproductive health numbers. Aap koi bhi number utha lijiye, gender se related, we are really the bottom of the pack. And so Shiraz was set up fundamentally to help more women keep their careers and grow in their careers. So the first version of Shiraz was a jobs and careers community for women. And the idea was that internet is such a great, you know, thing to happen to us, and we must use it to have, you know, to make sure more women are connected to workforce and more women have careers and they can make a living. And this is obviously, this is 2013, 2014. And India had maybe 10 million women online at that point in time, mostly in metros. You know, the number of women online was less than how much. But so we built a product for that. You know, so there's a full-fledged career community. There were resources. There were companies. There were peers. There were mentors. There were, you know, there was a full stack of a career community. And women could get a lot of support, look for work, find flexible work, find advice, you know, whatever helped them keep their careers.
FlexiMoms and Shiraz was the same stint only, or these were two different stints?
So FlexiMoms was while we were still at Saita. So it was really set out as a small experiment, but not really as a separate business at that point. So there was a question to say, what do you want to do? You want to run a boutique business? Yeah, but you have consumer internet. You know, so Shiraz was a brand new start in the same category, but FlexiMoms was a much smaller experiment.
FlexiMoms was what exactly?
So FlexiMoms was honestly a very simple experiment that went viral. So, you know, one day at Saita, we basically said, let's put up a platform where women can, you know, find flexible work and companies can talk to them. So we got a developer in Noida to make a very simple website with two forms on it. That was FlexiMoms. But because we were the first, and I think very, very early in the game, and I think FlexiMoms se pehle, if you looked up flexible work or work from home or, you know, back to work, these things didn't exist. And most of the internet was very scammy. You know, you would get all these get-rich-quick scams and things like that. We were the first ones to go to corporates, you know, the big corporates, Mahindras and Tatas, to sort of get them to sign up. And I think that sort of triggered a whole wave, you know, and that's what inspired us to also set out, you know, to build Shiraz in a real way, you know. So FlexiMoms was an experiment that went viral, and Shiraz was really like the result of that.
Okay, so you started Shiraz as a career destination. And this was monetized by the employers, I assume. They would have paid for listing jobs.
Yes, yes. So listing jobs, hiring women, services, everything. So
what kind of services?
Diversity, you know, policies, programs, back-to-work programs, demands, you know, things around women's career. Did that job. You know, for about 3 years, worked well. We had about 20,000 companies. You know, there was a time when Naukri used to be number one and LinkedIn and us used to be between number two and number three. So it was nice, nice for our ego. So as Shiraz, we've always run a helpline, which is how women could talk to us. You know, pehle wo phone line hua karta tha, wo chat helpline ban gaya, but that helpline always existed. And what we realized was that women coming to us are changing. Matlab, pehle Delhi Bombay se mahila aake baat karti thi, ab sab jagah se aa rahi hain aur sab tarah ki baat kar rahi hain. They're not just talking careers. So clearly, all in hindsight, Jio was happening, WhatsApp was happening, different women, new wave of users was getting online. So we really went back to the drawing board to say, wow, you know, this is something we wouldn't have really imagine when we first set up, but look, it's happening here, right here. So 2018, we rebooted Shiraz, relaunched as the social network for women. And the idea was to one, build for a larger base, and two, build for more than one use case. So it's a network of communities built around interests of women, and women can build their own communities. So it's a safe space for women to find whatever they might be looking for. Looking for work, looking for advice, looking for a safe space, looking for, looking to hang out, looking to share content, looking to set up a shop online, looking to buy and sell, you know, looking to post recipes. So, you know, so it's a community of women, only women, where they can do a bunch of things. Right? It's their social network.
I have multiple questions to ask you before we move ahead in the story. So you had a helpline in the previous Avatar of Shiro's. What was the business case for that helpline? I mean, this was like a free service to women. What was the reason behind doing that? Or
no, it's look, there is no business case. So helpline is not a monetized product. It's a feature. It's a feature. It's a service we offer. But the way I look at it is the helpline is a way for us to learn about the market. You know, women's internet is a new category, right? Most people don't even think it's a category. But the truth is, we will see in our lifetime a generation of products being built online only for women. Okay? And I think Shiro's will have like a significant stake in that story. But the helpline is a way to understand users. And it's also, it's a huge data engine for us to draw insights and trends. And the helpline is also a way for us to build trust. One of the reasons women use internet less and less is because it's a low trust environment. And we want to make sure that trust is maintained at all times. You know, and the helpline is basically a seeding of trust as we know it. And we don't charge for it. It still runs, by the way. In the COVID era, we're using it to help people, you know, resolve their anxiety issues, violence issues. Over 2 million queries have been answered, you know, on the helpline. So it's kind of, you know, it's a piece for community support. It's not a business case.
But I imagine that would have been quite expensive to run, no? You would need, like, a lot of agents who would be answering these calls and...
So actually, not calls, counselors. And it's a chat helpline. So only for a period in time, it was a agent and we had a phone line. In fact, those were the days when I used to personally answer it. There were three of us who would take turns to keep the company phone. But no, it's a counseling helpline. There are verified counselors available to talk to you, you know, 9 to 5. Working hours, you can speak to a counselor. It still runs. It is an investment. But we think it's an investment that's worth it, you know. And from what we get from the helpline, I think it's totally worth it. And also, you know, it also depends on the business strategy. You know, Shiro's has never been a push strategy. We have nothing to sell. We don't do incessant advertising. We don't do retargeting. We don't tell people to download our app. We just don't do any of that stuff that we like ourselves. So our users can reach out to us and talk to us, and we appreciate that.
Okay. And my second question is, why did you shut down the job posting? I mean, these could have existed in parallel also, like a social network and a job site.
No. I think bahut hi matlab impossible situation, and I'll tell you why. The job seeker is the most unfaithful user in the world. Okay? They have no intention to come back. You know, nobody wants to go back to a job site. Okay? I mean, even though we built it like a community. And the other thing that we wanted to do was, so we still run a workforce business today, but it's an enterprise business. We changed the model. In fact, now we help more women find work than we ever did. But the job posting business was a very low trust business, because you could post a job and you can apply for a job, but as a company, you would not have a hire, and as a person, you would not have a job. You know, because there was nobody who was sort of making sure this was happening, or nobody was curating that experience. Nobody was owning the stack, right? So the job board model is a highly inefficient model. And there's no way it can exist in a community setting for two reasons. One, the kind of users who come to us are not traditional job seekers anymore. They're micro entrepreneurs. They're first-time internet users. They're tier 2, 3, 4, 5 users. They use vernacular. They're not all English speakers. And two, look, jobs in India haven't grown. The footprint of women in the workforce has actually shrunk. It's not increased, because as jobs don't grow, women are not going to get the replacement jobs. You know, those are held by men and they continue to be held by men. You know, and unfortunately, that's where we are, you know. And so between the two, and I think also from a product thesis, you know, you have to sort of own the thesis of the product. If you want to build a social network, there's no way you can build a job site with it. I think they're very contradictory and their design fundamentally is very, very divergent.
So you do have LinkedIn as an example where, you know, community and jobs both exist side by side.
Yeah, but a LinkedIn user is a corporate user. Our user is a very diverse user, right? And it can exist, but LinkedIn is actually, I mean, I don't think the job seekers are personally enhancing the experience of LinkedIn for most of us, right? So, I mean, yes, it's a great tool for going out and looking for work. But I think the context is very, very different. You know, in our context, it didn't fit in. And, you know, also from the design of the product, what are we trying to do today? I think the direction we are working on is super, super massy and it's super high engagement. Jobs somehow don't allow it. Even at LinkedIn scale, which is global, you know, you have everybody in the corporate world, you know, you can't be somebody who's a small player in a very large category. You know, if you're a social network and you're a job site and then you're a subset of that, you're really left with nothing by end of the day, right? At least when we were a job site, at least we were a formidable job site, right? I mean, LinkedIn would look at us. But you try to do both, that's just a loss of focus.
Once you decided to pivot to a social network, what was the monetization strategy then?
Right. So look, the monetization strategy in social networks is very hard, but the thesis is that women are the best internet users there are. Everybody wants to sort of reach out to women, and two, women themselves are high engagement users. And what we wanted to do was set up an ecosystem that we can build and monetize over a period of time. So we have, three things that are sort of pillars of this. We have Workforce, which is an enterprise business we run today. We have Brands, which is a business that kind of is helping us scale the platform as well. And then we have peer-to-peer commerce, which is women using the platform to buy and sell, amongst themselves, not selling to us or buying from us. So that was the whole idea.
Okay. And could you tell me more about each of these, like how they're performing and like, you know, contribution to top line, and if you can share some numbers also?
Right. So our commerce business is only 3 months old, but it's doing, my sense is that it will overtake everything else that we've put in place so far. We have a workforce business, which is actually our...
So the commerce business is, on the commerce business only. So essentially anybody could list the product and you would take care of the payments, but not the logistics, or the logistics also, like how would it operate?
So basically, have you heard of a platform called Poshmark?
No, sorry.
Poshmark is a peer-to-peer platform. So... basically, think social content plus selling. So first, there is a lot of social content around what you want to sell. So it's not a listings platform. It's not an OLX. It's more of a Poshmark, if you will, or there's an app called Red in China. That's again. So content-driven sales, if you will, and some features to folks who are building content and conversations to monetize that sale, right? To either close that transaction or to acquire a customer. And as we grow, what we do is we are basically offering a bunch of tools to women on the network to set up their online shops and helping them inventory from other brands. So B2C brands, we are the silent platform here, and we don't do logistics or anything offline, but we do bring on board B2C brands. We bring on board a lot of people who want to distribute using the network. And then we enable women who want to be micro entrepreneurs, who want to have their online shop.
Okay. And what is the workforce business about?
Right. So the workforce business is a simple business. Basically, it's funny that everybody is talking about remote work now, and women always wanted to work from home, but it was always frowned upon. But what we did was we created a remote work certification. So women had to sort of set themselves up as a ready to work remotely worker. And we sort of put them on jobs that came from large companies, but in a scalable operational sort of way. So imagine running social media processes for a Flipkart or a Mintu, or imagine running backend for a Vivigo or a Black Bar. So large scale operational SLA driven processes for companies that had typically technology enabled stacks. Right, so new school companies that are scaling fast and don't want to invest offline. So that whole piece is managed by Shiro's. The business is called Mars, Managed Remote Solutions. You can look it up at marsbyshiro's.com. It's a enterprise business, and work with some really cool companies there. About 10,000 women work via this, and now we are seeing huge surge in this demand.
Right. Okay. What kind of revenue does that do, the work, if you're comfortable sharing?
Let's not put revenue out there. There are VCs out there.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah. Okay. And the brands business?
Yeah. So the brands business is basically brands building their presence on the Shiro's platform. So building their communities per se. So most consumer brands or any brands that want to sell to consumers, financial services, FMCG, appliances, consumer durables, you know, all these brands have certain needs. The need for insights, the need for sampling, the need to, you know, talk to users, the need for engagement, the need to create awareness, a lot of things which are not abundant, right, or direct sales. So we work with brands in creating solutions using this Shiro's platform for that. So typically, a brand would invest in creating a community. We would help them set up, scale according to their business objectives. So, so there we work with a bunch of brands, you know, some large brands, some small brands. And, so that's a whole brand's business.
Okay. So you've had three rounds of funding so far at Shiro's. Could you tell us about that journey? Like, how did you do the first fundraise, and was it very difficult to convince VCs about the Shiro's story and the subsequent rounds? And
right. So look, I think the first time we raised money was actually, I have to say, we have some of the best backers in town. So when I set up the company, I put in my savings, and Vijay Shekhar matched it. He was the first investor in the company. Rajan was the second investor. Then Benny Bansal was the third investor.
So how did they come on board? Like, what was that process like? Or is it like you had a relationship existing and therefore that built the trust? Or did you pitch to them? Or, you know, what was that process like?
So, look, I'd known most of them. Vijay Shekhar I've known for many years, and Benny I'd known. Rajan I'd known as well. In fact, Rajan was the person who encouraged me to raise money faster than I should. Even before Shiro's was set up, he'd kind of committed. So these guys were super helpful. Then Raghav Behl was an early investor, again, somebody I'd known from professional life. And Girish from Freshworks, Indus Ketan, Krishna Mehra, 500 Startup. And we raised money. Then we raised another institutional round. But most of the money we raised was when we were a workforce business. And we raised money when we are a consumer business. It's kind of strange, but that's true. Look, I think none of these guys are VCs. And the reason we set up Shiro's was because there's a very real problem in the room, and there's a real story, there's a real challenge here. As a society, as a country, as an economy, everybody gets it. I think from a problem statement point of view, it's slam dunk. And I think people were kind enough to sort of come on board because they know that, you know, I'm committed to it. But at the same time, I think every investor is not for every startup, and not every startup is feasible for every investor. So, you know, venture has its, venture is an asset class, you know, and LP-GP model is a very, it's a very lean model. It doesn't apply itself to a lot of business situations, right, or a lot of thesis. And the return expects is obviously very, very different, you know, from any regular asset class. So I think more than anything, it's just the fitment of the asset class, right, that you know, so VC is not a fit for everyone. We have raised VC money, just for your reference. We have Leo Capital as an investor. We have Loomis Partners as an investor. But clearly, you know, I think the thesis of the VCs matter a lot. And we do think we don't apply it. We're not a traditional VC playbook. We aren't fintech. We aren't growth.
Okay. So, you know, I think something which you are probably intrinsically very good at is networking and building a network. And to some extent, even your business is about building a network and to do networking. And I've seen that a lot of women hesitate to do networking. And, you know, if you were to make a list of top 100 people who are good at networking, and maybe 10 or 20 of them would be women and 80 of them would be men. So what is the secret to networking? You know, how do you build your personal network? And really, because it opens a lot of doors for you. And so, you know, do you have advice on that?
Right. So I always say, don't think of a network when you need it, right? Like, you have to build a network before you need it. And maybe you'll never need it. I think you have to intrinsically enjoy the process. You know, I personally enjoy meeting people. I genuinely enjoy them. I don't care whether I get something from them or not. I'm happy to help, but I really don't have an agenda to networking, right? I mean, I'm happy talking to people for who they are and what they're building. I'm curious to learn about their journeys. So I think networking is really not an outcome-based process, you know, and you don't know what will work for you, what will transpire. I think you have to leave some scope for serendipitous encounters to happen, right? So I think I never sort of really thought of this as networking all throughout until people started telling me that you network. And I'm like, okay, this is what you call it these days. Because, you know, most of my jobs were such where I'd meet a lot of people, right? From the time when I was, you know, helping MEA out and the VCs out, to working with CII, to working with, you know, consulting firm, to running my own business. Each of these jobs required a lot of relationships, right? So it took a period of time before they got built. And I built them with, you know, a sense of doing them with joy, right? Because, you know, these were people you worked with, or people you interacted with, or people you came in touch with. So, honestly, it was done much lightly than what it seems like today. And, you know, and given a choice, I wouldn't sort of, even today, I wouldn't sort of step out sort of network unless, you know, I'm excited about the conversation we're going to have, or unless there is, you know, really something that's interesting, you know, that's happening. So for me, networking was never networking. It was just sort of enjoying, you know, talking to people and working with them all along. And I do think as women, we are kind of not encouraged to do this. I think a little bit of why this comes naturally to me is because I spent most of my childhood hanging out with my dad, who was in sales and marketing. We always had, you know, visitors from all over the world, you know, come in, drop in for lunch, drop in for dinner. In those days, there were no mobile phones. We always entertained and we had guests at home, and I would always, you know, when my dad was having business conversations. And I learned to enjoy them a lot. Like, I really enjoyed the adult conversations, and it made me feel like, wow, this is so exciting. And I think, and I still enjoy it. I enjoy meeting people and having, you know, talking to them about their work and their interests and what they want to do and, you know, things they've learned. So I think I sort of carried that, you know, away from my dad. But as women, these are not things that, you know, we're kind of encouraged to do. We are not even encouraged to talk to other men, you know, for that matter. And women do have to make that extra effort, you know, and I do think that, but if you're going to have a career and if you're going to be, you know, building a business, you do need some amount of this done, prehand. Like, this should be part of the curriculum. This should be part of growing up years to say, to be able to build relationships with people, you know, before you meet them, before you have a use case, before, you know, there's a fire. Talking to people for the sake of conversation.
Networking is something which I personally also, I think, don't consider myself to be very good at. I'm somewhat of an introvert. And so, you know, can you give me advice? Like, how do I convert a one-off meeting into some sort of a long-term relationship? So say, for example, today we are meeting for the first time and we had a chat for about an hour. But what next? You know, I mean, how does this get converted into like an asset for me as a long-term relationship?
So I think, first of all, you just sort of break that framework of like, this should work for me. You know, you don't know which one is going to work for you, right? But there are some you will genuinely enjoy and there are some you won't, right? You have to also find your tribe, right? You have to find a tribe of people you care about or you wouldn't mind spending time with, or people you wouldn't mind working with, or people you wouldn't mind on your cap table, right? So, you know, so the way I look at it is that it really depends on who you are and what you enjoy. Like, I really prefer one-on-one conversations to, like, large gatherings. So I'm happy to make time on my calendar and spend a real hour as opposed to, you know, exchanging cards. Like, I think I would never do that. So, and then I think it's also following up on conversations, right? There's some people you have lots to chat with, and then some people you can't even find, like, you know, five lines of conversation. So I think there are clear sort of lines there on what's a good fitment for you. Think of it in that manner. And honestly, there's no playbook, and I wouldn't sort of even advise a playbook to network. I would really advise you to sort of loosen up and enjoy this a little more. Basically, talk to people you enjoy a lot more. And then find more of those people.
Okay, so we've had a conversation and maybe I would send you like a post-production version of it. But, you know, I would hesitate to really chat with you once the whole podcast is released. And I mean, I would think that, you know, why would you want to, for example, chat with me? And what is... So, you know, that hesitation kind of creeps in. And how do you overcome that?
So, look, you don't have to always have a conversation. You can keep in touch. You can say, this is going on. You can sort of participate. You can let other people know, at least people you find interesting, know about what you're working on. Like, I do this all the time, you know, small things that we're working on. I'll send it to some of the friends I think will enjoy, you know, whether it's a product beta release or whether it is, you know, an acquisition we made or something, right? Like, so I think it has to be contextual. Right. And I'm sure there are common threads, shared interests. It could be like a lot of people these days I talk to, we are having product conversations, you know, very simple things, but, you know, just little notes. Right. And, you know, so I think just finding that common ground and things you enjoy are common. It's really not about what the person can do for you. I think that's, you know, that's really a very small part of it.
So what is the direction you want to take Shiro's towards now? Like, what have you thought as the next step in the Shiro's journey?
So I think of Shiro's as a full-stack women's internet company. I see Shiro's as a large network. You know, maybe, you know, the goal I always say is 100 million women on this network. And what I see is that we'll definitely do more work in things that are more enabling for women. More work around workforce, more work around, you know, micro entrepreneurship, more work around maybe even microfinance, something that, you know, that we've been sort of, you know, looking at closely. So, yeah, I definitely want Shiro's to be a place on the internet that, you know, that offers them what they are looking for, them, right? So whether it's more money, it's identities, it's well-being, it's a peer group. You know, I dream of Heroes, you know, as being that company. And of course, we want to stay. We are an internet company. We're a small little startup in the, you know, at the end of the day, they're just hacking their way into doing things, right? So, yeah. And what I would definitely want to see more of is, more depth and range around things that we can offer to women via the Heroes network.
And how big is the Heroes team right now? Like your team?
Small team. We're about 40, 45 people.
And how did you manage the transition to remote? I mean, was it remote previously also, or, you know, during the lockdown, did you make that transition?
We have like a, you know, we were the first ones in this country to talk about remote. Like Flexi Moms are the first one to talk about remote work, right? Before anybody said remote work, right? But obviously, the challenges at that point were very different. So the team at Heroes has always been 30 to 50% remote. On any given day, you know, a lot of our community teams, client teams, they have always been 100% remote. Like and they're based in, you know, places we don't even know, Baruch and Bapi, and, you know, and now we've gone 100% remote. I think it's only natural that we do it. We are an internet platform. If we can't do it, then we will, right? And we run remote workforce business. I think we should walk the talk. So, yeah, so remote is, we were always set up for remote. Like, you know, our attendance on Slack, it's not on, you don't have to do a biometric check-in.
And what are your learnings of making a remote organization work? You know, because most companies, while they may offer remote employment, but I think, you know, giving like a fixed salary remote employment may not happen. They would generally be more comfortable as a freelancer. You know, maybe I hire a content writer and I pay her per word. So, you know, then it means that you're paying only if the output is there. But how do you build a company where you actually have people with regular employment, but you never see them, or you may rarely see them?
Like, you know, I think that's the whole thing. The remote work forces you to think about your business very deeply, right? What is the output you need to generate, right? And if that is very clear, then you should be able to run a remote organization. How does it matter where is the person sitting, right? Like, it's always, you know, baffled me. But look, I think if you want to run a seamless, dependable operation, you need a core team. You need a team that's available to you. It doesn't matter whether they come into an office or not, but, you know, are they delivering the work that needs to be delivered, right? You know, your tech team needs to be available, your sales team needs to be on the job. It's pretty much like, you know, what you would do on a, you know, in a regular office environment, except that now.
But do you change the way you hire so that you're able to hire people who can work remotely?
Right. So I think there are two parts to it. One is in operational roles, there is a certain, you know, certain amount of checks and balances required. So when we run the remote work business, we actually offer a certification first. You have to qualify it, and only 3,000 people out of 100,000 qualify it, right? So remote work is hard, but strategic roles, right? Product roles, for sales roles, you know, these are already strategic. You assume the person will have the self-drive and maturity to be able to do this, right? Will be independent in their skills and their decision making and their process and their thoughts. You know, I think clarity is what gets challenged when you work more, right? Because you don't have the liberty to sort of like spend, you know, a lot of time together. You don't have the liberty to sort of explain things face to face, which means organizational clarity is being challenged. You know, team clarity is being challenged. Team, you know, clarity of leadership is being challenged. And I think that's why people get uncomfortable with remote work, because and it's also a culture of questioning ownership, being able to drive things on your own. Remote work requires that. If you are a typical top-down command and control organization, remote is a very hard thing to run. You know, then you have control issues.
You must have made hiring mistakes where you hired someone and they kind of goofed off. You know, and what was your learning from that? Like, what is the way to hire someone who works well remotely?
Right. So I think there are two parts to this. One is hiring mistakes in general. And I think those are the most sort of expensive mistakes to make. But I think we all make those mistakes. I've made tons of them. And I think as far as I go, I think most of my mistakes have been on hiring people who look good in a general context, but are not very apt to our context. So I think letting go of our own context was a little bit of, things that I've done. But hiring for remote is really, basically, you have to up the meter on ownership, level of skill, and overall clarity, that a person brings to the table. You know, for somebody who can't sort of, let's say, document their thoughts clearly in a memo, is not really set up for them. I think these are very, very simple checks and balances. But, the idea of having to push your thinking into delivering output is a hard one. Some of the best organizations fail at doing that.
Okay, cool. So before I end this podcast, one personal thanks I want to give to you. So I, my other business, one business is of course podcasting, which is fairly new, but my bread and butter comes from Unnati, which is a recruitment firm.
Right.
And it was bootstrapped when I started off. I did not even have money for an office at that stage. And my entire leadership team today has been hired through Shiro's. So, I just experimented, posted a job, and found a really good person who was working remotely as a recruiter. And she inspired me to just scale up that way. So, today we employ about 60 women who all work remotely. And the entire leadership team came through Shiro's, but unfortunately, we can't post jobs anymore. So now,
I tell you, I got a lot of angry mails when we shut down the job board because people were like, why did you do that? And I'm like, it's a call, But I have to tell you, a lot of people tell me this, that their teams have come from Shiro's, and lots and lots of founders. When I go for some of these meetups. And lots of women also, even at airports, sometimes people will say, hey, I've got a job or I use the helpline. And I think that number of people who sort of just found a lot of, support like that is enormous, And I think that's core to us. And now, even today, I think a lot of this is happening on Shiro's in different contexts. The number of women who've written their books or who've set up their first business, who've taken online courses, who have sort of, got legal advice. So, we just sort of broadened our metric. But yeah, I hear this and it's good to know, and that was the idea of sort of, making internet work for women. Right?
Though I think the market is telling you that you should continue to run the jobs business also. With so many people coming and thanking you, I think that's like a fairly good data point which you should not ignore.
Right. So I am happy to fund this business all over again. If an entrepreneurial person wants to run it, like, I will incubate it, I will sort of seed it, give you the resources. But Shiro's has grown a lot, and now basically I'm building Shiro's like a portfolio. There are three businesses that are live. We're incubating another two. It's a company that's being built by entrepreneurs, right? So, and I see more and more of my role as incubating some of these. So somebody, wants to come and drive this, then we'll do it.
Okay, cool. Cool. Thank you so much for giving me more time than what we had slotted. It was great talking to you, and I will get in touch with you soon.
All right. Sounds good. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me here.
Yeah. Thank you for your time, Sari. All the best.
Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye.
So that was some great advice from Sari on hustling, networking, and building businesses. If you want to build an army of women to grow your business or brand, then look no further than Shiro's. Write to us at hello@thepodium.in for an introduction to Sairi.